and Kevin Walker at Station Q. So the title of the talk is Fermion Condensation and Superconducting String Nets. And the idea is that we'll take a fermionic version of Bose condensation to find new kinds of fermionic phases of matter. So here's the outline for the talk. I will start with the introduction to gap phases in 2+1 dimensions and how we think about them conventionally. Then I will talk about Bose condensation and the problems that would come up if we just naively try to condense a fermion, followed by how we do fermion condensation and do a very simple 1D example that I think is quite illustrative and realizes this Kataev-Majorana chain. And then at the end of the talk, I will apply those techniques to two-dimensional string net models, which realize 2+1 dimensional topologically ordered phases, and give one technique to analyze the particle content in terms of the tube category. Okay. And please ask questions at any point throughout the talk. Be very useful for me. So gap phases in 2+1 dimensions. So we want to look at maybe interesting surfaces, such as a torus, for example, and have some sort of lattice structure built on top of it. So we think of this as a graph, which will have vertices, edges, and plaquettes. And our Hilbert space will be built out of tensor products of local Hilbert spaces. So H sub V is meant to represent a Hilbert space associated with a given vertex in this graph. The Hamiltonian being local means that it's local with respect to this graph. So maybe it only couples together nearest neighbor vertices or vertices around a given plaquette. Now, immediately we have one choice to make. Our microscopic degrees of freedom could either be bosons or fermions. So here are some quintessential examples of bosonic topological orders. So one is the Torr code. So the Kataev honeycomb model, 11-1 string nets. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but just a few representative examples. Correspondingly, we also have fermionic topological orders, such as the fractional quantum Hall effect, P+IP superconductors, and also more recently, some exactly solvable models, such as the fermionic toric code. And you might notice that these guys are much more common in nature. So we actually have physical fermions around. So fermion condensation will give us a way of taking knowledge from these models and importing them into these ones. Okay. So it's believed that gap phases in 2+1 dimensions are described at low energies by a topological quantum field theory. So the local particles, or the excitations in the systems, are conventionally called anions. And we think about these as local excitations, modulo local operators. So it's a whole isomorphism class of wave functions that can all be related by local operators in the theory. But there's no way to turn one representative from that isomorphism class into a representative from another isomorphism class. Mathematically, the description is given by a so-called braided fusion category. So the anion types are called simple objects. These label the isomorphism classes. And the fusion rules are given by these positive integers n, a, b, c, which denote the number of ways that A and B could fuse into C. okay, so what will be very useful for us is to use a diagrammatic notation to keep track of the particle content in these phases. So for example, the fusion process would be given in, say this is a spatial dimension down here and time here. Two particles A and B could fuse into C in a number of different ways given by this multiplicity index. And diagrammatically, we would write down diagrams with labeled edges and vertices, which represent vectors in a given Hilbert space. So we call VABC here the fusion space associated to any graph that has labels A, B, and C on its external legs. A splitting diagram or particle creation would be found by just flipping this diagram over. Now we also have some physical constraints on the kind of diagrams that are allowed and properties of those diagrams. So one is that we have an identity particle, or you can think about it as the sector of local operators in the theory. And any particle must fuse trivially under the identity particle. So that's this relation here. And we should also be able to create particle-antiparticle pairs out of the vacuum. So for every particle A, there should be a dual particle A star, so that the vacuum appears in the fusion with itself. Now, we could have multiple ways of creating the same fusion diagram. So here I have, or the same wave function. So here I have a particle D, which splits into X and C, and X further splits into A and B. Now we could find the same three particles, A, B, C, through a different process, namely D splitting into A and Y into B and C. These vectors all have the same labels, so they live in the same fusion space, and so the bases have to be related by a unitary transformation. We call that the F symbol. Now, these F symbols are subject to other coherence conditions, such as the Pentagon equation, which I'm not going to write down, but it's just a constraint on the values of the F symbol. In a braided fusion category, we also have a braiding, which means given two particles that are localized here and here, for example, we should be able to adiabatically move them around one another, which diagrammatically we represent as this operator, which interchanges their position. And we use the R symbol to encode the unitary transformations on the ground space that these operators could impose. So here, again, we have two vectors that live in the same Hilbert space. External labels are the same, but internal labels are different. This guy has a braid with itself. We just say there's an extra linear relation on these diagrams given by the R symbol. And here I have a small disclaimer. For the majority of the talk, I will not draw the arrows, and I've already stopped drawing the fusion multiplicities. So you might be interested in what physical quantities can we extract from this data, or what physical quantities might we be interested in. And here I've listed a few. So one is the quantum dimension, which tells us sort of the local dimension that we associate with a given particle X in the theory. So this is a real positive number. It's equal to 1 if the anion is abelian, such as for the vacuum. And it's larger than 1 if it's non-abelian. Intuitively, we can think about this as the asymptotic scaling of what happens if we take many of these particles and tensor them together in space. So if we have n of these particles, the dimension of this Hilbert space grows as dx to the n. Another quantity of interest would be the total quantum dimension, which is just the square root of the sum of squares. This tells us roughly how large the category is. So the smallest dx could be is 1. So we know that for a theory that has n particles, this thing is always greater than or equal to n. And if some of those particles are non-abelian, it will be even larger. More interesting is the S matrix and the topological spin. These encode information about the statistics of the particles. So S is just the double trace. The trace of the double braid. And it also gives the change of basis on the torus. The topological spin is just the eigenvalue under 2 pi rotations. So if we take, if we think about this X strand as a ribbon, under a 2 pi rotation, that ribbon twists around itself, and then you can fold this picture onto the plane, and it would look something like this. Okay, so what we would like is to understand gapped fermionic phases in terms of data like this and the R symbols and F symbols, so some algebraic understanding of these gapped fermionic phases. So we weren't the first people to look at this. There have been many other references that I encourage you to look at, also coming at the problem from different perspectives. So one thing you can think about is just constructing explicitly Hamiltonians on the lattice and then actually looking at the spectra of these guys. Alternatively, you could try to develop the algebraic theory by consistency conditions and braided diagrams like I had on the previous page. Or you could try and look at wave functions rather than Hamiltonians. And so these techniques can all be related to one another. One is no better than the other, but they all give sort of complementary understandings. Okay, and if you look at all of these, look through the literature, what you find is that we need to update our formalism. And so what does that update look like? We need to replace local bosonic Hilbert spaces by super vector spaces. So this is just a Hilbert space that has p even fermion parity vectors and q odd fermion parity vectors. Now, in the bosonic case, it's just the usual tensor product we're used to. In the fermionic case, we have to take the graded tensor product. So if we tensor together two fermions, it really depends on the order that we tensor them together. If we interchange this order, we pick up a minus sign. When we have surfaces in the bosonic case, these guys need to be updated to spin surfaces for the fermions. So we need to be able to tell what happens when we transport fermions around our surface. In particular, if a physical fermion goes around a closed loop, it can come back to itself up to a plus or minus sign. Minus sign would be bounding spin structure, plus sign is non-bounding spin structure, and usually associated with vortices. Correspondingly, our anions now become a little bit more exotic. We have, again, anions in the fermionic case, but we now also have vortices. The upshot of fermion condensation is that it provides us a very nice technique which allows us to take all the data of a bosonic category and import it into a fermionic one. Okay, but before I do that, let me talk about Bose condensation quickly. And also, if there's any questions, I'd like to take them now. I guess not. All right, so Bose condensation. So what we do is take some braided fusion category, and we find a boson in the spectrum and try to identify it with the vacuum. And for now, you could assume this isn't a boson. And I'll show on the next page why it actually has to be a boson. So just imagine that we take some generic particle in the spectrum and try to identify it with the vacuum. This means that in the quotient theory, which I've drawn on the right here, the vacuum would be a superposition over all possible states where this boson lives in the spatial wave function. So here we have the original vacuum, and then 2A particles, 3A particles, and so on. And we should also imagine that these A's are really being treated like the vacuum in the new theory, so they can move around and braid with anything that appears from the parent fusion category in this theory. Mathematically, we've taken a fusion category C and added a single extra morphism to it, namely from the vacuum into this particle A. In the parent theory, this would be identically zero. Okay, let's be a little more precise about this. So take parent category C, we denote the quotient or condensed theory by C mod A, and we find this theory by introducing a single extra morphism from A into the vacuum, and also from the vacuum into A. So physically, this means that we can, in the quotient theory, locally create A out of the vacuum. We can also think about this as say, adding new interactions into our model or increasing the isomorphism classes of our excitations. Now, since we're now treating, in the quotient theory, A as part of the vacuum, we find that anything that braids non-trivially with A becomes confined. Or we can think about those as defects in the quotient theory. All right, so why does A have to be a boson? Well, let's think about the true vacuum for a second. It has trivial topological spin. This is one of the defining properties of the vacuum. Now, if we have an extra morphism from A into the vacuum, we can use this relation to get here. And then we follow the twisted vacuum line around itself with the new vacuum A. And what we find is that the topological spin of A has to be equal to 1, right? Because this picture has to be equal to that one. Now, in a unitary theory, the spin and statistics are related, but it's still useful to look what happens under exchange. So the vacuum braids trivially with itself, as shown here. We play the same trick, adding two morphisms from the vacuum into, or sorry, from A into the vacuum, and then follow those braided lines with A, and we would find that the exchange statistics of A also has to be trivial. So in order for us to consistently condense this particle, to think about it as part of the new vacuum, A has to be bosonic in its spin and statistics. Now, if we naively try to apply the same process for emergent fermions, we would run into problems, because an emergent fermion fails these relations in this way. You pick up a minus sign rather than a plus sign. Conveniently, it fails it in a very predictable way. So we will be able to add extra data to the category that compensates for these minus signs. That extra data is what will allow us to do fermion condensation. So let me describe that. The physical picture is to think of some bosonic topological order, which I've drawn here, that has an emergent fermion in it. And I draw the emergent fermion by these red squiggly lines. Then we take a gap phase of physical fermions and stack it on top of this bosonic topological order. So we can think about this as a p-plus IP superconductor, for example, and the physical fermions is like BDG quasiparticles. Now, since they're physical fermions, they come with a spin structure, which I draw as this arrow here. And also, we need some sign ordering. So if we interchange their ordering, we pick up a minus sign, namely if we interchange 1 and 2. Then we add some local interaction to the stacked theory that binds the emergent fermion to the physical fermion. So now we have a composite particle where this emergent fermion is always stuck to this physical fermion. And we can show that this composite particle locally behaves like a boson. So I'll do that in the next two slides, but before, let me just get some notation down. So I'll denote this bound state as an odd isomorphism from the emergent fermion to the vacuum through this physical fermion. And we also need to say how pairs of these physical fermions can disappear into the condensate. So if I have a pair of physical fermions connected by an emergent fermion, I can remove it at the compensation of some complex number, which I'll call lambda for now. Okay, so let's verify that locally this composite composite object is behaving like a boson. So here I have an emergent fermion that is oddly isomorphic to the vacuum. I play the same trick as before, twisting the vacuum line with itself and following the vacuum line with this emergent fermion, physical fermion composite particle. As I do that, I find that the physical fermion rotates by 2 pi. Which means it picks up a minus sign from this. And while it does that, it twists the emergent fermion around itself. So we get another minus sign from the emergent fermion. Those two signs cancel each other, and we find that the composite object is locally a boson in its spin. Now, what about its statistics? So we take this diagram and exchange the vacua lines with themselves. Follow those vacuum lines through with the physical fermions here and here. Then we find that the ordering of the physical fermions has changed. So we pick up one minus sign from interchanging the indices 1 and 2. And we've also braided the emergent fermion with itself. So we get an additional minus sign from that emergent fermion. Consequently, this particle is bosonic in its statistics. Now, the thing that differentiates it from an actual boson is that it's odd, so it's an odd operator, it carries odd fermion parity, and it also has a physical fermion attached to it, so it's sensitive to the spin structure of the surface. So this will have some consequences in terms of what quotient theories we find. So let me just do a quick example. The simplest non-abelian theory that contains a fermion is the Ising TQFT. So there are three objects, the trivial object, a fermion, psi, and a non-abelian anion, sigma, that fuses with itself to 1 plus psi, size a fermion, so it fuses itself to the vacuum. And sigma is invariant under fusion with psi. Now, to condense psi, we consider all possible net configurations or diagrams in this theory modulo these additional relations that will define the quotient theory. In particular, any diagram can be written in this form. So I've left out identity lines. And any diagram in the parent theory can be written in this form. And using these two relations, I can always remove any of these psi strands at the expense of replacing them with pairs of physical fermions. So in the next slide, I do that. We take this diagram considered in the quotient theory. So the first step, I pull pairs of physical fermions out of the vacuum connected by emergent fermions. So here and here. I need to keep track of the sign ordering. So I have indices 1, 2, 3, 4. I use the trivial fusion rules of the or trivial F symbols for the emergent fermion to recouple these lines. Then I take the physical fermions and pull them back across the emergent fermion lines until they're sitting next to the sigma strand. And then a convenient notation is that whenever I have this picture, I'll just replace it by a blue dot sitting on the sigma strand. Now there is the one subtlety that it depends on which side of the strand that the physical fermion sits on for this blue dot. We have lost information between these two. But we can take care of that by adding a braiding to this physical fermion with the sigma strands. I'll explain that in a few moments. But first, let's just analyze some consequences of this. So in the quotient theory, I'll change the labels so we don't get them confused with the parent theory. So I'll denote the vacuum as the same, so 1, but I'll also say that it's oddly isomorphic to the emergent fermion. And sigma will have an image of some particle, which we call beta, in the quotient theory. And so the sigma, this previously labeled sigma strand would become a beta label. Now we see that beta can have an odd isomorphism back to itself, which means that the endomorphism algebra of beta can have an odd operator in it, or said another way, it's isomorphic to the Clifford algebra, CL1. Objects of this type are often called Majorana objects due to their relation with Kataiv chains and Majorana chains. And one way to see that is to notice that if we just consider these beta-type particles, the degeneracy of the Hilbert space will just be the parity of the chain. So we'll have even parity states and odd parity states. This can be made more explicit. So for example, we could consider a 1D string net. So a string net in general is just a Hamiltonian which implements local relations given by a category. So we can think about the manifold here as just being an interval, and the local relations as being isotopies of this dot. Namely, we're allowed to slide it along the strand. And we can also pull pairs of that dot out of the vacuum. To construct a local Hamiltonian, which realizes the Hilbert space of this 1D string net, we imagine cutting up this interval into several pieces. So we have many intervals now. And then the Hilbert space is given by any allowed labeling of these intervals. So on each interval, we could either have a fermion there or no fermion there. And there's a Z2 grading, so we have even parity vectors on this top row and odd parity vectors on this bottom row. What does the Hamiltonian look like? So we need the Hamiltonian to implement local relations given by the TQFT. So one local relation says that fermions should freely slide across these strands. So you can check that if you stack this operator on top of this junction here, the fermion which is sitting here will be transported to a fermion which is sitting over here. Once you remove this pair of fermions off that interval. Similarly, we should find that pairs of fermions can be added to the system for free. So the same operator will implement that local relation, given again just by stacking this guy across that interval. As a projector, you can just write the Hamiltonian like so. And if you write this in terms of actual fermions, you'll find that this is exactly the 1D zero correlation length Kataev chain. In terms of wave functions, you'll find that there are two states, an even parity state and an odd parity state, and the wave functions are just equal superpositions over all possible configurations of fermions sitting on those intervals with appropriate weights sitting out front. You can explicitly find Majorana zero mode operators. So there would be one sitting at the left side of the system, if you call it gamma left, and one sitting at the right side of the system. Since the Hamiltonian only acts on these junctions, it doesn't act on the furthest most left and right strands, meaning it will commute with these operators. Furthermore, they square to themselves, or the square to the identity, they anti-commute with each other, they anti-commute with fermion parity, and commute with the Hamiltonian. These are exactly the properties of zero-mode operators and guarantee degeneracies in the spectrum. It turns out the same analysis will carry through in the 2 plus 1 dimensional phases as well. That's why I wanted to present that here. But before moving on, let me just talk about the braided picture of the condensed theory. So in the bosonic case, we say that if we condense a particle, anything that braids non-trivially with this boson becomes confined in the condensed theory. So one option is to do that for the emergent fermion, physical fermion, composite particle as well, or fermion condensed phase. So we could say that anything that braids non-trivially with the emergent fermion becomes condensed in the quotient. That's fine. Another option is to say that the particles which braid non-trivially with the emergent fermion in the parent theory also bind physical vortices for the physical fermions in the condensed theory. So one way to keep track of that is we could consider this string of diagrams here. We have an emergent fermion, which is oddly isomorphic to the vacuum, and then we isotope it around this particle x. Now, if x braids non-trivially with psi, naively we run into this problem. The way we fix that is by saying x binds a vortex for the physical fermion so that it picks up an additional minus sign relative to the bounding spin structure. Okay, there is a third resolution to this, which is back wall condensation. So there we say that physical fermions can never braid in front of emergent particles, the theory, which means they always live at the back. And it turns out this is equivalent to doing this on the Drinfield center. So on the Drinfield center of the fusion category. But I think personally I prefer this picture because it's much easier to keep track of spin structures in 2D and calculate associators and braidings and so forth. So let me describe back wall condensation in a little more detail. So we think about, we mostly forget about the braiding of the parent theory and just view it as a fusion category, but do keep the braiding on the fermion. So we have, as a fusion category, we have net configurations that can live on the front side of this box here. They take different colors, yellow, black, blue, and so on. And then we also have one emergent fermion, which can braid with all of these guys. And we always imagine that that emergent fermion has to go behind this picture. So this is always one kind of braid that we see. And that emergent fermion can terminate on this back wall as long as it terminates on a physical fermion. So this back wall will have a spin structure, and it will also have places where physical fermions can live. A small caveat is that we don't actually need the fermion to live in the fusion category. It could just be one that lives in the Drinfield center. Okay, how do we find associators for this theory? Well, associators can be found just by taking our fusion diagram, like so. We could displace these physical fermions off to the side, and then we just have a picture in the parent theory. We use the associators of the parent theory to find a picture that looks something like this, and then move those physical fermions back to their original locations. Composition of morphisms is just given by stacking and then modding out by these local relations. So one subtlety is that if this particle here, y, happens to be one of these CL1 type objects or Majorana objects, then we have to quotient by fermions being allowed to tunnel across it. So these pairs of fermions would be, we would be able to remove those in that case. This construction is nice because it gives a consistent fusion category in the condensed theory. We don't have to go through and find all sorts of different coherence conditions to solve, because it may be hard to actually construct a complete list. Rather, we appeal to the consistency conditions of the parent bosonic theory in order to make sure that we end up with a consistent fermionic theory. Okay, so that's the end of the introduction. I talked about gap phases. I described how we get how we can construct fermionic fusion categories using fermion condensation, and gave this 1D example of how we find a Kataev chain by using this construction. And those Kataev chains are always associated with these CL1 type objects. Now I want to use fermion condensation to describe string nets. Are there any questions?
Yeah, that's a good question. To what extent is your, the way you construct is different from how I was taught about fermion condensation? Is just you take two fermions and you make a pair out of them, and then you...
Yeah, it's very simple to that, except they're connected by an emergent fermion. So it's if you just did that, it would be our background, the phase that we're bringing nearby our bosonic theory. Now we're adding an extra interaction that says, in addition to that, we also have to have a pair of emergent fermions that sit on top of it. Any other questions? Oh, okay, good. So how do we do string nets? I kind of think of this as turning a crank. So our input is a fusion category and a surface. So here's a torus. And we feed it through this crank. And we end up with a local spin model living on top of that surface whose excitations are in one-to-one correspondence with the simple objects of the Jernfeld center. In the fermionic case, it won't be a local spin model, but it'll be a local model with supervector spaces. And or local Hilbert spaces will be supervector spaces. And in order to keep track of the fermion signs, we will also need to equip the surface with a spin structure. So it has to be a spin surface. The Hamiltonian implements local relations of the fusion category. So for example, it would say that strands can fluctuate all over the system into any isotopy-related configuration. So in a little more detail, we put some lattice on top of the surface. So here is a triangulation. It doesn't have to be, a trivalent lattice. It doesn't have to be trivalent, but it's convenient. The Hilbert space is given by the collection of graphs that is colored by objects in the category. So each edge carries one label from the fusion category. So this would be like label A, for example. This could be label A, B, C here, and so on. The whole collection of these colored graphs gives the Hilbert space. In order to denote those, we can just choose a vector from the fusion space of the three strands living nearby it as the local spin living at that vertex. And the total Hilbert space would just be the tensor product over all those local Hilbert spaces. In the fermionic case, this is a graded tensor product. So it cares about the ordering of all of our odd vectors. And the local vector spaces are supervector spaces. So the Hamiltonian looks almost identical to the string net Hamiltonian. Namely, there is a vertex term, which enforces the fusion rules of the three objects labeling the edges coming into a vertex. Violations of this term would be an excitation where strands across an edge don't match labels. The ground space of the vertex term would be any allowed net configuration by the fusion rules. So any net configuration satisfying the fusion rules drawn on this graph is in the ground space of this vertex term. Okay. Then, in addition to the vertex and plaquette terms, we have one new term, which is an edge term. And it says if there is a Q-type object or CL1-type object connecting two vertices, then we have to add this additional local relation. Namely, we can pull pairs of physical fermions out of the vacuum, place them on that edge, and then fuse them into the adjacent vertices. So here's an example of that. We have some edge in our system labeled by a Majorana-type object. And the edge term would say that configurations with pairs of fermions sitting on there is equivalent to one with no pair, and a fermion sitting here is equivalent to one sitting here. So it just gives us hopping and pairing across those. Consequently, such strands are again Katayev chains, or Majorana wires, sitting inside our net configurations, but dressed by the additional labels coming from the fusion category. So if we don't consider the plaquette term, we have our low energy states, our states that satisfy the fusion rules, and require that CL1 type objects carry Katayev chains on top of them. So I should mention that similar models were found for sort of the Ising mod psi theory, given in terms of Majorana-dimer models. So this would be like Z2 fusion rules with Majorana chains sitting on top of the Z2 labels. The plaquette term is the same as in the string nets. So it's some omega loop whose job in life is to be able to transport strands across it. So if I had a strand sitting on one side of the omega loop, I could isotope it across for free. The one subtlety is that if your X object here is a Majorana type, then we have to divide by a factor of 2. OK, in terms of the net configurations, we can think about transitions between states given by this operator, which is given by just taking a strand and pulling it across the plaquette. So we pull the strand across the plaquette and then fuse it into the remaining part of the graph, remaining part of the net configuration. The precise coefficients appearing here will depend on the F symbols of the theory. Now, as far as understanding the explicit excitations of the system, there's a much more convenient way in describing the string net, which corresponds to this picture. So for every plaquette, we on our surface, we remove a disk somewhere in the interior of it. And then our basis of net configurations is all possible diagrams that we can write down on this surface that may or may not terminate on these disks. Okay. So this is some huge selection of vectors. It's also a supervector space because these net configurations could have even or odd fermion parity. The Hamiltonian is given by gluing a cylinder or annulus into one of these disks with an omega loop on it. So for example, if I have this plaquette here and then I glue the cylinder on top of it, I find the same plaquette but now with an omega loop around it. Then I can use local relations in the fusion category to reduce this net configuration to a linear combination of net configurations appearing in this list. And of course, that will require using a bunch of F symbols. Another way to think about the Hamiltonian is to say it is the trivial idempotent in the tube category. What that means is there, well, okay, let me go to the next slide. So the tube category provides a very nice way to understand the excitations in the system. So if we look at the Hamiltonian as the trivial idempotent in that category, every other idempotent, which are operators, which are orthogonal to the trivial idempotent, will identify an excitation in the model. So just some background. The tube category has objects given by circles with a number of marked points sitting on them. Since we're working with fermionic theories, these have to be spin circles, which means we have two spin structures to choose from. There's either a bounding spin structure or a non-bounding spin structure. And depending what language you prefer, bounding means anti-periodic boundary conditions or non-vortex. And non-bounding means periodic boundary conditions or that it's a vortex. Morphisms in this category are given by net configurations between any two circles which match the boundary condition. So here's a tube. It has bounding spin structure across the tube. And this morphism is just some net configuration that I draw on there. And of course, it's subject to local relations of the fusion category. So I could recouple these lines in whichever way I like. Composition of morphisms is just given by stacking. Okay, so the isomorphism classes of the excitations are in one-to-one correspondence with the minimal idempotence of this tube category. So what's a minimal idempotent? It would be given by a linear combination of tubes of this form. This is a complete basis for the tube category. It does not matter exactly how many labels you choose at the boundary. You'll always find an equivalent number of isomorphism classes, although the explicit representations may change. A minimal idempotent is defined as one of these guys subject to this relation. So they must be orthogonal and also projectors. And then if I sandwich the tube category between the same idempotent, I must find that as a vector space, this is isomorphic to C or CL1, or that it's one-dimensional. said another way, we could think about the tube category as a tube algebra, in which case this corresponds to block diagonalizing that algebra, and the minimal idempotents are the diagonal elements of those blocks. So the reason this is a very convenient picture is that it allows us to understand the fusion rules, the F symbols, braiding, and S matrix all in a very straightforward way. So for example, the fusion rules would be found by taking a pair of pants to glue these tubes together. The S matrix could be found by projecting these tubes onto the torus, which would correspond to gluing these boundaries together, and then rotating that torus by 90 degrees. Dane twists are just rotations by 2 pi, and so on. So now I just want to say some universal properties about the excitations that we can find with doing little to no work. So one question that we could ask is, what do the particles look like for idempotents that have a bounding spin structure? And it turns out these are just deconfined particles of the type that we're used to, namely they are anions. One way to see this is to imagine that we have some anion described by idempotent EI and the Dane twist operator here, which is just a 2 pi rotation of the boundary. Now, if we had an odd isomorphism, then we know that we'll find another idempotent that is conjugate to EI, found by sandwiching it with this odd operator. And since T anti-commutes with any odd operator, because it pulls the fermion around a bounding spin structure, we know that the topological spin of the idempotent found here will be minus that of the original one. And we would conclude that there is no way that this minimal idempotent could have an odd endomorphism, but it could definitely be oddly isomorphic to another idempotent, namely this one. The story is different when we consider the non-bounding spin structure. So these correspond to vortices in the system, which we'd like to manage in as sitting far apart. We could think about creating them dynamically out of the vacuum. One would do so by violating a number of edge terms sitting between the two vortices. So here this d sub e would have negative eigenvalues on these edges. And we would find an effective spin structure around the plaquettes corresponding at the ends of those violations that corresponds to a non-bounding spin structure. Thus, those guys are characterized by the non-bounding idempotents in the tube category. They're also confined. So we have to violate a linear number of edge terms as we separate these particles. However, if there are no CL1 type objects in the input fusion category, then these guys actually do remain deconfined because those edge terms all become trivial. Right. OK. So then you can ask about the character of those vortices. For example, we could ask, can they be CL1 type? Or are they, again, just like defects in the conventional anionic setting? And it turns out that these could either be sort of standard anionic vortices, or they could be vortices which have these odd endomorphisms. So these are sort of analogs of vortices in like P plus IP superconductors, but in the string net setting. So for example, if there were non-bounding idempotents with an odd endomorphism, which maybe looks something like this, then this tube would commute with the Hamiltonian, would square to the identity, and anti-commute with all other odd operators, or anti-commute with other zero-mode operators, and also the fermion parity. So it's all the usual characteristics of a zero-mode operator. And indeed, we can think about these vortices as binding Majorana zero-modes. An interesting fact is that in the fusion rules of CL1 type particles in a fusion category, we could find that two CL1 type objects fuse to a third CL1 type object, which is kind of counterintuitive when you think about them as Majorana objects, because we'd want Majorana objects to fuse to the vacuum. What saves us is that in any braided theory, since CL1 type objects only live over a non-bounding spin structure, we know that two CL1 type objects would have to fuse to a non-CL1 type object, namely a non-vortex. So I just wanted to say a little bit more about what the excitations in this theory look like explicitly as their wave functions. To do so, I would appeal to the Ising example, although what I say applies more generally. So in Ising, we started with three objects. There's the identity, sigma, and psi. We condensed psi, which resulted in a fermionic theory which had two objects, the trivial object and beta. Beta had an odd endomorphism and fused with itself to vacuum in two different ways, either evenly or oddly. Now it turns out that if the fusion category is actually a modular tensor category, meaning it has an invertible S matrix, then then the tube category of C would decompose as C cross C bar. The tube category of the quotient decomposes as C cross C mod psi, if C is modular. Now, this provides us some insight as to what the actual wave functions look like. So we take some, so for the Ising theory, our wave function would be some huge superposition over all possible configurations of nets labeled by beta. On top of each beta strand, we have a Kataev chain. An excitation would be labeled by a pair of objects, one coming from C and one from C mod psi. And the way to find the amplitudes for the wave function is to just take a strand and lay it over top of the net configurations, as I have here, and one from beneath. The strand on top would take labels in the category C, or Ising. So it could be one sigma or psi. And the strand on the back is allowed to have fermions that go into the back wall. So it only takes labels in the fusion category C mod psi, which would be one in beta in this case. Now, if the strand on the back has trivial statistics with the emergent fermion, then it describes an anionic excitation or some deconfined excitation. If it has non-trivial statistics, then it describes a vortex. So this would be the beta particle here. So in Ising, we would find six particles. Three of them are anions, have the same fusion rules as the usual Ising theory, with some, fermionic additions. And three Majorana type objects, or vortices, that are confined particles in this theory. Okay, so let me just summarize the data associated with the excitations. Naively, we might have thought that there are four kinds of excitations, because we have two kinds of objects, so anions or CL1 type objects. And then we have two kinds of spin structures. So multiply two by two and you get four. We showed that one of the quadrants of this table doesn't exist, so we can't have bounding idempotents that are CL1 type. However, we showed that Bounding idempotents are always deconfined particles and behave very similar to anions. The vortices could either be sort of conventional defects in string net, or they could be these Majorana type objects, CL1 type. The excitations would look something like this. You fuse those strands into the wave function. And yeah, so there's some other things you can show, like that the tube category is isomorphic to C cross C mod psi. I didn't go through that. And so let me just finish with a summary of the talk. I introduced gap phases in 2+1 dimensions and braided fusion categories, and one way that we use those to describe these gap phases. I talked about fermion condensation in the context of this back wall. So meaning we take a bosonic theory with an emergent fermion in it, stack on a theory of physical fermions, and add a local interaction that binds the emergent fermion to the physical fermion. This results in some quotient theory. We showed that some of the particles in that theory are intimately related to these Majorana chains. And then I described some universal properties of the corresponding string net using this tube category. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and take any questions.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks, guys.